couple months ago, there was like this consensus that Unibot is the token for the next bull run. Make sure to like Unibot, Rollbit, and I'm sure there was a couple more, but I can't remember. And then like they had such a strong first movers advantage, and they kind of just let it die out. I feel like this is one of those big first mover advantage fumbles. Not as bad as OpenSea, but I would say like definitely top five.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Zero X Research. March is just around the corner, and I wanted to make sure to give you a quick reminder to not top tick your prices of your DAS London tickets. If you use codes 0x10 at checkout, you can lock in a 10% discount on your ticket. Don't miss out on your chance to get ahead of the curve. I'll see you in London.
Before we get into today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in this episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. All right, let's jump into the episode.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Zero X Research. Today is Monday, March 11th, so this episode will air on Wednesday, March 13th. And today we are joined by Westy and a new face, Boccaccio. Welcome, Boccaccio. Thanks for coming on from the Blockworks research team to jam on the latest market happenings. I just realized Boccaccio and Westy are apparently roommates to anyone who's listening to this on YouTube rather than listening on Spotify or Apple. But anyways, Ren, do you want to kick us off with a little bit of news and governance updates?
Yeah, for sure. Boccaccio and Westy also moved in with Effort Capital from what I heard and seen. They have like nighttime jam sessions in the living room together. But the Kickstarter news and governance updates for this week, Eclipse announced a $50 million raise this morning as a Series A's, and basically, they're going to use that money to build out the SVM as a roll-up that leverages Celestia for DA and Ethereum for settlement. I think this is sort of like a nice intersection of multiple narratives. You know, the DA narrative is very strong, Solana and its virtual machines. The whole SVM narrative is also very strong, but ultimately, you still want to build that where the users and the liquidity is, which is Ethereum as a settlement layer. And it'll be interesting to see Eclipse kind of execute at the intersection of all of that. I'm going to touch on a few more Solana-related things. Camino, KMNO, the native token of Camino on Solana, will snapshot for its airdrop on March 31st. There was some like community discussion around this. I think they're doing a fully like linear snapshot, so there isn't like any tiers, sort of like what Jito did. And apparently, I think there's been some community pushback and discussion around that. I know they changed a few things, but I'm not sure what exactly they changed. And the last thing, which is kind of Solana related, is that Injective launched its INEVM, which aims to bring composability between Cosmos, Ethereum, and Solana like VMs under one network's umbrella. So there's kind of like three different Solana related headlines there. You guys have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely excited for Eclipse to launch for all the reasons you said. Full disclosure, I am an investor in this round. And yeah, one of the things that was interesting that Neil recently tweeted was he's basically trying to juice the sequencer as much as possible, taking advantage of like a single sequencer type of environment. And so I'm super excited to see what kind of performance you get out of one sequencer juiced to the max, as opposed to having to have a full validator set, which I don't think any other L2 has really tried their best to maximize performance as much as this is going to. So I think that's definitely a worthwhile experiment, pushing the limits of what's possible.
Yeah, I can touch up a bit on Camino. I'm kind of not upset, but this might be a bit of a rant. So like in my year thesis, I talked about how these dApps on Solana need to airdrop to attract capital to the chain. But I think Camino is doing it in kind of a weird way, because like if you, and this is what the community was talking about, Ren, but if you announce it, it's just going to get diluted. And the fact that it's linear, I feel like Solana is already not a very rich chain compared to Ethereum. So I think you really want to give out tokens to users to kind of increase volume and TVL across the chain. But if you just give it to, say, the whales, even though I don't necessarily like that term, I feel like it won't give what Jito gave to Solana, which is this activity, this volume, the people who are actually trading on Solana. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I generally agree there. In terms of sort of like airdrop distribution, right? I understand the want or the desire to make your whales rich because these are like the largest drivers of your protocol or your dApp's activity. But at some point, I do think it has diminishing returns, right? If I'm worth like, I don't know, like $10 million, I have $1 million worth of assets deposited on Kamino. Like the difference between like a $3 million airdrop and like a $1 million airdrop probably isn't that much. You know, past a certain point, it's just going to be like, holy shit, that's a lot of money. It doesn't matter like how much money there is there. And so I do think like a tiered system makes a lot more sense. Sure, I think maybe Jito went like a little crazy with the tiers. I think like the bottom tier got like 1,000x like more Jito per like soul deposited than the highest tier. Maybe you don't need to like make it that extreme, but I do think like overall a tiered system, even like if just like very very slightly tiered, is better than whatever like Kamino is doing with their sort of linear distribution.
Yeah, I agree with that. And on the first note that you brought up, Ren, in terms of Eclipse raising, I'm just very excited to see SVM experiments like in faster paced environments, because obviously Solana is like pretty decentralized at this point, has a lot of moving parts, a lot of entities you got to get on the right, the same page. So I'm just keen to see the innovations that come about for the SVM that ultimately help Solana, but also help Eclipse, that can occur just in a more centralized way in the beginning and hopefully reaching to like more decentralized on that spectrum as the project evolves.
All right, moving on to some other news and governance updates. The ETH ETF is looking a little less likely, according to Bloomberg analysts James and Eric, as they see no signs of proactive attention from Securities and Exchange Commission, unlike during the run-up to the Bitcoin ETF approval. I think, personally, I generally agree with this stance. I don't think an ETH ETF is happening this year. The Bitcoin ETF took so long, went through so many like regulatory hurdles, and after like God knows how many years, it finally reached the point of where it was this year when it finally got approved. I feel like the ETH ETF is just like a narrative that people are trying to latch onto. Sure, I do think like some of the price appreciation is due to the ETF, but I just don't think like the ETH ETF is gonna get approved. If I'm looking at this from like the SEC's position, they're like, dude, I gave you like your Bitcoin ETF already, you know, like don't ask for too much. ETH can wait till like, I don't know, like 5 years later or next cycle, right? And then following some other news within Ethereum land, but also within Solana land, I guess, Wormhole fixed their airdrop checker, and many users are finally reporting that they are now eligible for the Wormhole token W. I know there were some snafus or perhaps unhappy community members around the distribution, and they made some not normal, like, I guess, airdrop decisions compared to like a normal like airdrop, including like distributing the airdrop to like some select communities and having some like requirements for that in place. But yeah, so if you think you're eligible for the Wormhole airdrop, go double check that again today. Any comments there?
One thing on this is, if you're ever wondering what like pure anger looks like, go on a project's Discord after they released their like airdrop checker or whatever it is, and that's like when you see genuine hatred from people. And it's just like, it's sad, but it's also very, very funny.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. I agree with that big time.
I think this is just also to the Wormhole team. Please make it so that if you have Rabi, you can check the airdrop, because it's just like, I had to go through so many hoops to get on MetaMask again. But I'm very excited for more Wormhole. I think it's going to potentially be the best airdrop this year. I don't think we had any other this year, though. Like over the past, let's say, 6 to 8 months, I think it's going to be a really good one. And in general, I'm very excited for Solana teams to do proper airdrops and good ones, and not like what I assume Kamino will be like.
Is Wormhole the first airdrop to do this vesting thing? Because I know MATLAB holders receive 16,000 W in total. They get 3,200 at the start, and they get the rest vested over, I want to say 1 year, but maybe it's 6 months. And I feel like I haven't seen like vested airdrops. I've seen like normal airdrops. I've seen airdrops where you get like a call option to purchase the token below market price. But I don't think I've seen a vested airdrop. And I'm interested to see how that changes the dynamics. I think it's like a relatively small portion of the airdrop supply, but it's still interesting to see nonetheless.
Yeah, no, they released their methodology for this airdrop right before we started filming. So I don't know if you guys had a chance to check that, but it was like the Mad Lads were the only group of entities that had this vesting schedule. So if this was applied to other NFTs that gave the airdrop to, I think it'd be a cool experiment to see how that changes maybe price action or user behavior, etc. Because it obviously incentivizes these types of users to stay involved for at least a year, if not more, as opposed to potentially just selling and leaving. But yeah, I don't know if this particular experiment you'll actually see like the results and be able to take something away and apply it to your own airdrop.
Do you know if lads that, you know, get the initial airdrop and then they still have things vesting for that wallet or tokens vesting for that wallet, if you transfer that lad, does the new owner have the claim to claim those tokens that are vesting?
I don't know with 100% certainty, but I'm like fairly sure that it's tied to the Mad Lad itself and not the wallet address. And the reason why I believe that is because it's basically a part of the badge within the wallet, within the XNFT. And when you check your specific wallet on like the wallet checker for the airdrop, it doesn't come up within that allocation. So my guess is it's not tied to the wallet, it's tied actually to the NFT. So if you were to sell it, then the new owner gets whatever rights are left. So if you, let's say, want to sell after the initial airdrop, but you don't want to wait for the vesting period, you can sell your LAD. Now the new owner will get the vested W over time, which is interesting.
That's super smart. Yeah, I like that idea, honestly, because then it kind of provides a little bit of intrinsic value to the actual LADs for the next year. So maybe Tristan and Armani, or just Armani, not Tristan, sorry, can get a little break.
Going back to the ETH ETF conversation, I feel like I've been banging the drum, whereas CT seems to think the ETH ETF is a guarantee at this point. I still think it's around like 50% that it gets passed. And like Ren said, it seems from the ETF experts for that probability is probably lowering slowly and slowly at this point. Like I think looking back at the Bitcoin ETF, that was only really approved from like a 3 out of 5 vote from the SEC, where Gary Gensler himself was the tiebreaker. And I felt like he only voted yes because his hand was forced by the court case. And so, I mean, I feel like his hand isn't really forced in this case, and that the SEC can make up whatever reasoning they feel like to deny the ETF, and that's all it takes, really. I think the ETF is eventually going to happen, especially if we get a better or more favorable administration this fall and next year. But yeah, I still put it at 50%, maybe slightly lower of passing.
Yeah, I also follow up your debt. I think ETH is going to do remarkably well this cycle too. But I don't think that an ETH ETF will be as large of a supply sink as people think as compared to the Bitcoin ETF, right? You're seeing like $300 million net inflow days, $600 million net inflow days. I think the peak was like $749 million or something for Bitcoin. I wouldn't be too surprised if ETH ETF is like one whole order of magnitude smaller than that. Sure, there are other like fantastic supply sinks for ETH right now, especially with like the whole like restaking and RRT protocols. I think the amount of ETH that's restaked continues to go up, and just ETH that is staked normally. But I don't think the ETF is going to have as large of an impact on sort of like the supply as people think.
I'll actually disagree with that point. Push back a little bit. I'd say if it is put through, then I think it'll have very valuable inflows, maybe not on a like per dollar basis as much as Bitcoin is, but the flows will, I think, impact the price much more, given that it has a smaller market cap, has a deflating supply. Like, I just think it's much more favorable for pushing up the price than Bitcoin, even if it gets much less flows. And we kind of saw that with Grayscale in the last cycle, where their Bitcoin trust had like 6 times as much flows as their ETH trust, but ETH went up 3x. So I think it's going to be something similar along those lines, where yeah, like the total dollar amount of inflows will be much less, but I think it'll have a huge impact on the price.
All right. That's it for the news and governance section. Next, we're moving on to the DYDX segment.
All right. We are joined today by Carl, one of the DYDX grants contributors. Carl, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to be here. Yeah, of course. So the grant subDAO, which has since rebranded actually to the DYDX development program, just received 2 years of runway extension via DAO vote. Can you kind of explain, I guess, the DYDX subDAO architecture and how this grants, which is now the development program, fits into that?
Yeah, for sure. So DYDX is obviously a pretty broad ecosystem at this point, but it has kind of these three buckets of core contributors. So there's kind of the core trading team, which is responsible for building and updating the code that's being used to deploy on chain. So whenever you see like a software upgrade or anything like that that's being updated on chain, that's because the core team has shipped some new version of the protocol, and that's being deployed on chain as a result through a community vote that's being done through the validators. Then there's the DYDX Foundation, who supports the protocol and kind of overall ecosystem with community work, governance work. They help kind of foster the ecosystem. And then there's the underlying community. So that's kind of the third bucket. And the community, as with most other protocols, is made up of token holders, users, validators, stakers, and then contributors, obviously. So within the community is where we've, as a whole, developed a few subDAOs, just kind of forming them in order to help the community manage and maintain certain important responsibilities that are kind of key to being able to maintain the DYDX protocol, given that the other two buckets might not necessarily be capable or have the means to manage them. They more fall on the token holders through governance or through maintenance or whatever it might be. And so these subDAOs were launched with the goal of, okay, let's give the community the power to take control here and kind of appoint certain contributors in order to manage those. So Grants was the first one that launched over 2 years ago. It has kind of its main mission is really just to help promote the growth of the protocol through development, infrastructure, really anything that helps kind of build a protocol, and through ecosystem growth, through community initiatives, kind of recruiting more contributors and just generally like promoting the protocol across the space. And then the second one that launched was the operations subDAO. So that was responsible for maintaining the core infrastructure of the DYDX protocol, which launched a little bit more recently. So really you could think of subDAOs as community contributors that are hired by the community in order to take on these responsibilities such that more just like action and more can occur via this kind of community bucket.
That was a great tee up for next week too, actually, because the ops subDAO is going to be the next DYDX short. So.
Yeah, great.
That played out pretty nicely, but what are the plans with the funding extension of 2 years that you guys got recently from the DAO? Like, what types of initiatives are you most keen to fund?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, what we've learned running the grants program in the past 2 years is that it can be tricky and it can be dangerous to try to foresee everything ahead of time and try to kind of estimate what it is that we should be funding. But generally speaking, we've been very excited with helping sustain and grow the infrastructure and kind of the protocol through hiring more contributors and through hiring service providers that can help kind of like run key infrastructure components that help kind of DYDX run. So previous examples have been like hiring a team to run the first instance of the DYDX indexer, which is responsible for all kind of like the data availability of the DYDX protocol. We've hired like Mintscan, Kepler, lots of other service providers to help run core kind of community infra, like explorers and wallets and that sort of thing. And then on the community side, we're really excited with a few different initiatives to help kind of continue scaling the ecosystem and promoting the DYDX environment and making it really fun to interact with.
And what, in your opinion, like, would you say, like, 2 years from now, if you're looking at, you know, all the work that you guys did, what would make it look like a smashing success to you? Is there any specific KPIs that you're looking at?
Yeah, KPIs are an interesting one when it comes to grants, because we don't like to associate ourselves with we funded X amount or we distributed X amount of grants, because that would imply that we're just handing out money, right? We want to make sure that we measure impact, which can be tricky to measure just because how do you actually determine what is impact when it comes to you know, a grant deliverable on a protocol. But from our perspective, if the grants program has had a significant influence in the direction and the growth of the protocol through either onboarding new contributors who have gone on to build something that is used regularly by the protocol, or through recruiting contributors that are playing a key role in kind of maintaining core infrastructure for the protocol that helps it run efficiently or just has allowed it to continue growing. And then also just, have we done a good enough job to continue building out the ecosystem such that being a part of the DYDX community is a fulfilling and kind of fun position to be in.
Yeah, that's super cool. And honestly, we could do a whole episode with you guys over at Reverie to kind of dive into grants sometimes, because obviously there's no silver bullet here and it's a very fluid space. So plenty of stuff to touch on, but unfortunately today we're out of time. But Carl, thank you so much for coming on. We'll have to do it again.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
All right. Now for the hot seat, Kuzron. Wesley, I'm going to throw it over to you first this week. I know we got a lot of sort of really big news that broke last Friday. So we'd love to hear what you have on the Kaziku throne.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have on cool throne, depending on where you guys put it, might be the hot seat, but I have MakerDAO adjusting the DSR to 15%, which is up from 5% where it was previously set by the DAO. And this is in addition to updates to the borrow rates of the platform for crypto-backed loans. So they increased the borrow rate for a bunch of the ETH vaults to above 15%. And then above 16% for the STETH and Wrapped Bitcoin vaults. So while this may seem like a huge jump, it is still the cheapest venue to borrow against your ETH across DeFi and exchanges. On Aave, I believe it's around 20% right now, for example. This is simply just indicative of the current market environment where there's a higher demand for leverage to capture returns generated by the market. Since we're obviously seeing immense returns within ETH, Bitcoin, and alts at the current moment. And also, like, increasing the DSR is a necessary step to ensure continued demand for DAI, because otherwise holders of DAI or SDAI or those that have locked within the DSR will sell their DAI in order to chase more lucrative opportunities. And this will subsequently obviously drop DAI's price and then leads to arbitragers swapping their DAI for stablecoins in the PSM and then ultimately reducing the number of stablecoins Maker has in their reserves to keep the peg stable. And they also use the PSM to invest in RWAs. So if the PSM balance falls low enough, they'll dig into the current set of RWAs, looking first at the ones that are most liquid to build those reserves back up. We actually saw on March 3rd of this year, so around 8 days ago of this recording, we saw the PSM drop to a new local low of $185 million, which was likely one of the bigger reasons to spark this change in rates to help facilitate more demand for DAI at the current moment. If you take a look at the projected annualized revenues calculated by Maker Burn, they almost doubled from around $100 million in annualized profit to just under $200 million. So this also plays directly into the Maker thesis of having countercyclical sources of revenue. So while rates are high, RWAs will be yielding a lot. And when rates fall, the demand for leverage brings in a greater amount of revenue from these crypto-backed loans. I personally think it's a good move and a necessary move given where the markets are and the need for more DAI demand. And I definitely recommend listening to the episode that Sam and Red did with a bunch of people last Friday, including Hasu, Vance, and Steakhouse, talking about Maker Endgame and why the demand for DAI is super important and where those sources come from. But yeah, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this move.
I've got a question for you, Westy. I've been seeing a lot of people on my timeline attribute the increase in interest rates and the DSR to Athena's launch. And I agree, Athena is like a huge deal, and packaging that, Delta neutral trade with the basis and future spread as like pretty huge. And obviously on $1 billion of capital at 60% yield in the middle of a bull market, that's like $600 million of money, like real money being returned to on-chain users. So would you say there's legitimacy to that claim, or do you think that's mostly overblown?
I think there's definitely a legitimacy to that claim. Like I said, this is a move in increasing the demand for DAI overall. And obviously, if there's a competitive stablecoin or synthetic dollar on the market that's yielding a much higher return than DSR, then demand's obviously going to wane from DAI to this new synthetic dollar. So you kind of need to compete on some level. And I also know that like the plan for DAI and SDAI is for it to be used throughout DeFi, throughout layer two, such as Blast, that are trying to have native yield. Like they want to be actually utilized, have the DSR be utilized, and therefore drive DAI demand across the ecosystem. And my guess is that USDE from Athena is a good competitor to this, to providing native yield to a synthetic dollar. So yeah, I definitely think this is in part a reactionary move to that, as well as just a reactionary move to lowering DAI demand and rates increasing throughout the market in general.
I have one more question for you. Sorry to keep you on the hot seat, I guess, even though this is a cool throne. That was a not on purpose, actually. But is the profit, like, I don't understand how the profit doubled considering the borrowing rates and the DSR increased drastically in tandem. Is the AUM and that 1.5% spread between the DSR and the borrow rate really just, is it that much to the point to where it doubles revenue from 100 million to 200 million? Like, am I understanding that correctly?
So my intuition is that there's much more like DAI being borrowed from these crypto-backed loans than there are DAI in the DSR. Therefore, like the actual revenue generated is much more significant than the amount that's going to be paid out through the DSR, assuming that the DSR remains at the same number of DAI deposited. Obviously, you might assume that the DSR increases the number of DAI that gets deposited, and therefore the actual amount of profit generates falls, because that's obviously part of maker's costs. But yeah, I believe that is likely like the biggest case for why you're seeing a huge jump in profit.
I really like the counter-cyclical nature of the business. I mean, it's kind of like, say, like Robinhood. Like Robinhood has like $3.5 billion on their balance sheet. So in a high interest rate environment, they just print off interest revenue. But then on the other hand, in the low interest rate environment, which I'm not sure we are in yet, they make a lot of money off like just like trading volume as activity comes back. I think it makes sense for MakerDAO to do this move and adjust the DSR up to 15%, because thinking we're going to like a lower rate environment and the demand for leverage is obviously here, right? So you might as well jack up borrowing rates to make as much interest revenue as you can. One point that I'll be interested in seeing is how sensitive they are to like market conditions. Is this something that they're going to adjust like every month as market dynamics change, or are they going to be like a lot more careful about it and maybe only change it like every 6 months? Because there is a very real scenario where they might overdo it, just like how sometimes the Federal Reserve overdoes like interest rates and the economy becomes too hot or too cold. It's very possible that they juice up the DSR too much, borrow rates go too high, and they handicap sort of like DAI growth within the bull market, even though the demand for leverage is there. I'm not sure how like the decision-making process behind this is and how they came up to those numbers, but yeah, I would be really, really curious if, do they make a lot of like micro changes like every like 2 weeks, or do they make adjustments like every like 3 months, for example?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that as a part of this, they also reduced the amount of time it takes for them to implement a new change. I believe they reduced it by like from a couple days, like 48 hours to 12 hours, I believe. So I think they're going to be ready to respond to changes in the environment whenever possible, but I don't think they're going to be updating this super regularly, just monitoring and then being able to react to changes.
Just riffing here, I also think that this move was pretty partially like driven by Athena, and thinking of this from like, there's two policy tools available, right? One is adjusting the borrowing rate, one is adjusting the DSR. I'm trying to think which one is a more like effective lever to keep Maker solvent, I guess, or like the peg stable. I think the borrow rate is a more effective lever here, because chances are Athena's funding rate stays pretty high, or like SUSDE stays pretty high as market conditions increase and improve, right? And the demand for leverage stays there. I wouldn't be surprised at like the current market cap if SUSDE's like yield stays, I don't know, like some ridiculous percentage, like 50% for like the next like 6 months, right? And if you think about the levers that which you can like toggle from MakerDAO between the borrow rate and the DSR, like it's hard to increase that DSR to a really ridiculous percentage to make it competitive with what SUSDE is paying out today. And so I think the main lever here should probably be the borrow rate, although that obviously like dampens the DAI growth.
Yeah, that was my main takeaway actually from our conversation the other day. And actually it was Brick who co-hosted, sorry Ren, but it was a good conversation, and my main takeaway was demand is something that the MakerDAO community hasn't focused enough on. That was at least my takeaway. And I think that we're seeing in real time them address the demand problem, because obviously they're trying to attract people to lock stuff into SDAI and grow the DAI supply. But my one worry is just, why would you borrow from MakerDAO at 15% when there's other venues to do it cheaper? But it's going to be interesting to watch play out.
I will say Maker is still the cheapest place to borrow your ETH at the current moment. Like, obviously it's a fixed rate, so that could change any day. But right now, like, Aave is around 20%, and I'm fairly confident that right now it's the cheapest place, but again, that could change.
That's surprising to me. I didn't know that. That's a good flag. I guess I just ousted myself as not being a leverage whore, if you will.
Yeah, I think one last point I have here is it'll be interesting to see how DeFi protocols respond to like competitor DeFi protocols when like the market dynamics change. I think DeFi as a whole is a lot more developed than what it was like in 2020, 2021. There's so many more protocols these days, and there's like enough protocols within a sector that like they're kind of able to influence each other's dynamics, especially in like the lending and money market sector. So it'd be interesting to see like who else makes sort of like business strategic moves based on like some other protocol doing something.
One issue there I feel like is that only really happens on Ethereum, and like on other chains they're just forking Aave and there's not like a lot of competition. On Solana I know they have margin fee. I don't want McBrennan adding me on Twitter and saying we do it, but I feel like it's really only on Ethereum and potentially a bit on Solana at this point, like people actually coming up with competitors and doing cool stuff, et cetera.
What's up, everyone? March is approaching fast, and I want to give you another reminder not to miss out on DAS London. It is coming. It's right around the corner, and it's in March from the 18th to the 20th. We have 3 full days of content. This is your chance to bump shoulders with some of the world's top executives and have open dialogue with both attendees and speakers. We're going to be focusing on a range of topics that I'll let Ren discuss for you.
First on the list, we have Bitcoin Catalyst, the halving and spot ETF. Next, we have a view from the buy side from investors on things like strategy, portfolio allocation, and more. We also have a topic on RWA's tokenization and stablecoins, which I think we can all agree are going to play a large role in crypto's future. We'll also talk about global regulatory frameworks like compliance best practices and the evolution of global standards that are shaping the global investment landscape. We'll also have someone from the institutional front to talk about infrastructure such as banking and payments with financial giants like Visa and JP Morgan. And last on the list, the macro case for digital assets. So don't miss out on this monumental event. Seats are limited, so be sure to register today by hitting the link in the description and using the promo code 0x10 to save 10% on tickets. See you in London.
Maybe that's a good time for me to hop into my cool throne. Mine's super easy this week. I feel like I've said that the last 3 weeks in a row, but I've got Michael Saylor in the cool throne. He bought 12,000 Bitcoin for $822 million, which brings the company's cost basis to about $33.7K. It recently announced, so I think it was March 5th, the closing of an $800 million offering of convertible notes due in 2030 at an interest rate of 0.625%. So this isn't super surprising that they, of course, YOLO'd it into Bitcoin. But what was really surprising to me, honestly, is just the insane rate. Like that 0.625% is just so cheap to borrow money. And maybe that's normal for convertible notes. I'm really not super familiar. But to me, my takeaway is it kind of sounds like a call option for the lender. And they basically get the ability to purchase or convert the loan into shares of MicroStrategy at, I think it was about $1,450, which was a 40% premium at the time, but MicroStrategy is already trading above 1600 as of today. So good on that lender, not sure who it was. So MicroStrategy's Bitcoin holdings are up to 205,000 Bitcoin, which is getting very close to that 1% of the total supply that will ever exist. They'd hit that at 210,000 because there will obviously only ever be 21 million Bitcoin, which is just pretty mind-boggling, honestly. Like, this guy is unbelievable. I can't believe he actually has bet now a total of about $7 billion in mark-to-market. It's worth over $14 billion. He got absolutely destroyed the last 2 years. And like, just like all of us have, like friends and family being like, you know, what are you doing in crypto? Like, you know, this is kind of a joke. And except he was like on a global like scale. So I can only imagine how hard that was to sleep for the last 2 years for him. But that conviction is pretty electric. I'm not sure what the end game is here. It's obviously just a software company, like a smaller one that just holds a lot of Bitcoin. So I don't even know what they plan to do with it in the future. I guess it's, yeah, I don't know. But I definitely don't condone Saylor going on TV and telling people to take out debt and buy more Bitcoin. But at least he's leading by example. And I think he is actually the biggest degen out of all of us. So hat tip to Michael Saylor. Not sure if you guys have any things to add here.
Think it's this is like probably one of the better examples of how like this entire like financial engineering process could have turned out. There's definitely like a lot of ways this could have turned out pretty disastrously. Other than Michael Saylor, I think one buyer that I'd be interested in seeing how much Bitcoin they've been scooping up is Tether. So in 2023, Tether had announced that they started like purchasing Bitcoin. I don't remember how much it was, but I feel like it was like a relatively significant amount, you know, like maybe maximum of like $1 billion. And at that point, they also had a few other holdings on the sheet. I think like they also bought a bit of gold and people were like, oh, you know, this is like the return of like gold and like hard money backs, like US dollars, you know, in Tether's case, USDT. So I'll be interested to see if they've been buying up the dip because if they did, like they would probably be up a pretty ridiculous amount to be honest. So yeah, that's who else I'll be looking at right now in terms of like BTC holdings.
This is, I don't know if you guys saw, but Saylor had an interview today and he was just smiling the entire time for like however long the interview was. But I think like apart from Tether, I'm also excited for, this is something I see on Twitter a lot, and it's, I feel like Avi Feldman talks about it, and one of the things he talks about is like the next top will be marked by, or no, the next bottom will be marked by nation states capitulating. And I wonder how many like states are actually actively buying Bitcoin at this point. I think it's the only one I know is obviously Bukele and El Salvador, but I'm sure like there's a lot more.
I'd take the other side of that. I don't think nation states are buying Bitcoin right now. I think we might get like a mid-tier, like top 70 in global GDP, buy some Bitcoin this cycle, maybe like two or three. And people are going to be like, oh my God, the floodgates are open. Like all the nation states are about to be scooping up Bitcoin. But I find it just very hard to believe that they're doing that yet, especially considering the government is like trying to offload, the US government is trying to offload their Bitcoin. It's like, why not just sit on that? I feel like that's a good insurance policy.
I also think that there's a decent amount of nation states where like the treasury or their balance sheet of the central bank is too large for them to deploy in a Bitcoin in like a meaningful manner. Like even like a 1% allocation for some of these like central banks is like just going to move the market so much that it's probably not worth it for them. And if you're like a developing country, so to say, you probably shouldn't be yeeting money into Bitcoin and watching that as a, like as that draws down like 60% in a bear market.
Yeah, I think there's going to be potentially some opposing forces. Maybe you have one small, maybe two nation states buying Bitcoin, and then you have others that are going to start banning it. I believe Nigeria banned Bitcoin pretty recently, and we're probably going to see other third world countries or like start to ban it as well. So I think that'll be interesting. I also think it's been weird watching the MicroStrategy stock price just rip, continue to rip, despite, like, you'd think that people were only buying it previously as exposure to Bitcoin, and now that they have Bitcoin ETFs that they'd sort of migrate, but you still have these speculators buying up MicroStrategy. It's above its 2021 cycle high, whereas other like mining stocks or Bitcoin adjacent stocks have not made new highs yet or aren't even close. So yeah, it's been weird to see the stock continue to climb, and obviously Sailor's can take complete advantage of the stock price climbing to buy more Bitcoin. So power to him.
I still just can't get over like the Larry Fink snippets I'm seeing on CNBC of him being like, it's a store of value, and like battling the CNBC Squawk Box like host who's saying like, well, you know, gold, silver, like they're used in things. He's like, yeah, but Bitcoin's a store of value. It's like, yeah, that guy definitely like had a late night with the boys and like figured out crypto and is definitely like fully ingrained, because he seems to actually have a bit of an understanding on how like tokenization, Ethereum and stuff further out on the risk curve actually works. So I'm super excited for like the next 5 years to see how this evolves.
All right, I think that's a good point. I'm going to shoot over the hot seat throne to myself. This week I got Gito in the hot seat, actually. So last Friday, Gito announced that it suspended their alternate mempool offered through the Gito block engine. And they cited negative externalities it caused users of the chain. And apparently this convo has been in progress for quite a long time, to be honest. It wasn't like a sort of spur of the moment decision. However, bundles and other block engine functionality will continue to operate as normal. So the bundles is allowing the people to submit bundles, giving people like sequential and atomic transaction execution. And then the block engine is responsible for a few things, including ingesting transactions from the relayer, forwarding those transactions to searchers, ingesting bundles and transactions from searchers, performing simulations, and selecting the best and most profitable transactions for the network and for validators. I think there's been some speculation as to why they made this decision. The sort of ongoing theory out there is because of Telegram bot users. A lot of these Telegram bot users are setting a ridiculous slippage of, I don't know, 50%, 90%, 99%. And obviously, once these transactions are sent to Gito's mempool, a searcher comes and say, okay, you set your slippage to 50%. I'm just going to slip you for 50%. And that's not like a very good experience, so to say. And validators were making a lot of money. I think there was one day, I know I kind of analyzed this, but John Sharp analyzed it, so I'm going to use his annualization. There was one day where basically if you annualize that number, validator tips were on track for 550 million. So that's a lot of money at stake, to be honest. But yeah, I think now the network dynamic has obviously changed without this mempool. Now you just get better execution because the trades don't get sandwiched, but it lowers the probability of the transaction getting included faster, because we go back to sort of where Solana was pre-Gito, and searchers are incentivized again to spam transactions to the network in order for transaction inclusion. And I think pre-Gito, the numbers were like really, really ridiculous. Like 94% of transactions on Solana were like failed transactions or like something that was like really insane. But yeah, Gito came out and basically said that they're going to push in a different direction that will be more fruitful, profit, and user experience-wise. I'm really curious to see how they solve that and how they sort of design a more profitable model, because I don't see a more profitable model, at least for like the Gito, the token, without going back to like extracting MEV. So that'll be interesting to see. And as far as profit goes, you know, at least the bull case for like token value accrual is not there anymore, because Gito, I think, used to charge like 5% on validator tips, and overnight that basically disappeared, right? And Gito's Souls product is essentially the same as Marinade's now. And I think once you flip that switch and you sort of like succumb to community pressure, it's hard to turn that back on. You know, if Gito ever makes a decision to say, hey, okay, we're like re-enabling MEV, but this time, like, you can capture less or whatever, like Solana will go, yo, what? Like 6 months ago, you say that you're going to stop like your mempool offering and like Solana's not going to have MEV. So yeah, I think it's hard to compare this to Ethereum directly because Ethereum is pretty different. Ethereum has like a public mempool by default, which means that if you want to protect transactions, you need to send them to some like private RPC or mempool, where Solana doesn't have that, right? Solana basically took the opposite approach. They have a private mempool by default. And so on one hand, you want sort of pre-execution privacy for your transactions so you don't get sandwiched. But on the other hand, you also want to enable some form of MEV so that you prevent network spam. And of course, I think a lot of questions have revolved as to why won't someone else just like fork Gito and create the exact same thing, create an alternative mempool. There's obviously like network effects to Gito, which I think made it so successful. But given the economic incentives that are now there and amount of money to be made from MEV extraction on Solana, I don't think it's too impossible to envision someone else basically building a Gito competitor with especially the mempool offering. But I'm going to take a pause there. Would love to hear your thoughts because I think this was a pretty like heated issue, to be honest, on the timeline.
Yeah, it sucks seeing a team like get a ton of social pressure to basically get rid of a huge value driver for their products. And I tweeted a pretty hot take the other day that I think if a user sets their slippage at a high enough level and they end up actually like their max slippage to a high enough level and they actually hit that as the real slippage, that the user is not being harmed because that was within their intent. Like, so for me, I don't see this specific example as users being harmed. But at the same time, obviously, it's not an ideal case for transactions to be sandwiched. And one interesting tweet from Buffalo was basically that because Solana transaction fees are so low, any possible trade will be sandwiched as long as it goes through an external mempool. Because otherwise, on Ethereum, like if the fees are high enough so that it's not actually profitable to sandwich a given trade, it won't be sandwiched. That problem doesn't exist in Solana. So every single trade will be sandwiched as long as it can be sandwiched, which is a pretty difficult problem to solve. I'm sure they've thought through this a lot and are currently thinking through a lot of solutions, whether that's, you know, encrypting part of the transaction, only allowing back running and not front running, things along these natures. I'm sure there's a lot of work being done behind the scenes for them to make this decision to temporarily suspend their external mempool. But it definitely sucks to see that like social pressure seems to be the best way to mitigate MEV at this point, as opposed to actual technical solutions.
Yeah, I would take the side of I agree with the move from Gito, even though they did kind of give into social pressures. I just think like the people aping these meme coins don't actually know what they're doing with Telegram bots. It's easy onboarding. They're just YOLOing into the latest meme coin. They have no idea what their slippage is set to by default, and then they get screwed that way. So I think it was the right move in general. And I also think down the line, and this is like a consensus take at this point, so yeah, it's like not my original thought, but like you might as well grow the pie. And then Gito can figure out value accrual further on down the line. Make the user experience as good as you can, and then figure out value accrual. I mean, they're building out critical infrastructure. They've got the network effects through the airdrop. Like, I think Gito's here to stay, and I think I'm not worried in the immediate term about returning MEV and exploiting users and extracting value from them is really the right way to go forward. So happy to see it.
On one hand, like, I think to like people trading in their like stock brokerage, right? If you use like a slightly more sophisticated stock brokerage that's like not Robinhood, and if you like do a market order, at least like on the normal UI, you don't get the option to specify like your maximum slippage, right? So I do think that's like an interesting thing that crypto has. And sure, I get that a lot of like that is abstracted away in Telegram bots, but I do feel like it is up to the user, you know, you're like expressing a preference for how much you're willing to get slipped. on your swap. Sure, it will be nice if you don't get stiffed to like the maximum stiffage that you set, but you did kind of like put an agreement on chain and say, hey, this is something that I'm okay with, and this is the maximum that I'm willing to tolerate. So I'm kind of in the middle, you know, like on one hand, like I do think that like in some forms, like MEV, especially like sort of like atomic arbitrage between like different pools, is definitely like a valuable thing. But on the other hand, I think an interesting thing about Solana is that its block times are so short. So if you wanted to build something like a MEV blocker or MEV share, right? Like Jito already adds 200 milliseconds of latency to a standard Solana block, which is like a 50% increase in the block time, given that a normal Solana block is 400 milliseconds, right? And I think long term, they're trying to aim for like 200 milliseconds. So if you try to do like a MEV block style auction to like searchers and return that value to the user, I'm pretty sure that's going to take longer than 200 milliseconds. But then again, you know, maybe like Solana's too fast for its own good. I don't know if that's like a really stupid take that's going to get me a lot of hate. But that's definitely like a possibility, you know, because like these blocks are so fast. So you can design a lot of like these auction mechanisms that perhaps take a little bit longer time, you know. But also if you're like a user, I'm not sure how big of a difference 400 milliseconds or 1 second makes, to be honest. You know, if I'm coming from, I think anyone that comes from Ethereum to Solana says like it's amazing. So maybe like someone native on Solana and started their crypto on Solana will feel the difference between 400 milliseconds and 1 second, for example. But perhaps someone coming from Ethereum wouldn't. But yeah, just a few like interesting dynamics that I think will impact what Jito will do from here.
My main thing on the Solana side is the transaction fee mechanism. Like I personally find the UX of using Arbitrum smoother than Solana, just because like half the time when something busy is going on, like I can't get a transaction in. It is so frustrating, and that's why I'm so excited about Eclipse. Like I really want to see this transaction fee mechanism get implemented this year on Solana mainnet.
Yeah, totally agree with you. I think that's a good point to pass it on to Boccaccio. So last but not least, who do you got in the hot seat throne?
Yes, talking about Telegram bots, I am putting Unibot on the hot seat today. So they announced today that the Unibot core team decided to part ways with the team which deployed Unibot on Solana. And just for context, Unibot on Solana, separate from Unibot, launched on Solana late December, early January, which was around the time where a lot of like meme coin activity started picking up on Solana. I think WIF was at 3 million, which I remember, and I was like, it's a bit much now. Yeah, this was like the first wave. And then, so according to the Unibot on ETH team, they decided to split because the Solana team wanted to launch their own version. No, they decided to launch their own EVM Unibot on Blast, or they made the attempt to, which is obviously kind of impeding on the Ethereum bots territory. And they also refused to KYC, which I would have assumed that they had already KYC'd and knew each other quite well if you're giving somebody like your brand name. And they didn't want to pay fees to ETH Unibot holders. And this was already kind of like a weird launch from the very beginning, because they allowed this random team, now that we know, like not random, but non-KYC team, to launch on Solana. And they airdropped the Unibot on Solana's tokens to ETH, but they still ended up diluting the original Unibot token holders because they launched a new token and only gave up like 80% of it back to ETH holders. It was just like kind of a botched launch, but it was at a good time, because I mean it was a good play, because like now we know all meme coin activities on Solana, and like there's a lot of people putting 50% slippage, so many people that Jito's like, hey guys, let's relax, like maybe let's get rid of MEV for a bit. But that's it, and like that's the honestly, like my take on this is kind of, I'm just really confused about it, because I'm like, why did you guys just And from what I understand, the Unibot team is just kind of lazy and they didn't want to like actually develop the app on Solana. This is what Twitter is saying, so it could just be a rumor. So they just gave it to a dev shop. But it's just like, I don't know if you guys remember, but in a couple months ago, there was like this consensus that Unibot is the token for the next bull run. Make sure to like Unibot, Rollbit, and I'm sure there was a couple more, but I can't remember. And then like they had such a strong first mover's advantage and they kind of just let it die out. It's a bit of a shame. I feel like they had a good brand. I know there's other bots. I don't want to name a lot of Telegram bots on the podcast today, but I know there's others that are much better than it. But it's just, I feel like this is one of those big first mover advantage fumbles. Not as bad as OpenSea, but I would say like definitely top five.
It's a weird story, to be honest. I agree with you, Boccaccio. It feels like they went on Fiverr or like some like random dev shop is like, hey guys, we want this to be built on Solana. Like, can you build it out? Oh yeah, by the way, you promise you're gonna give like 50% of revenue to like us, right? Pinky promise. And then like they just went from there. I do think that there's a larger question. I would guess like 99.9% of brands in crypto haven't sort of like filed a patent for their IP or like trademarks. So like, is it that illegal to copy someone's brand and launch it on another chain? Like, ethically questionable, yeah, for sure. Illegal, maybe not if you didn't file like your trademark. But yeah, just like a really weird dynamics. And yeah, I agree with you, it seems like a shame because obviously they launched like their uni bought on Sol, uni Sol token, and sure, like I feel like all things considered, that token decision was relatively okay since uni bot holders were only getting diluted by like a very, very minimal amount. You know, they were getting like 90 or 95% of the token supply, and the Solana users were only getting like 5 or 10% of the supply. And the tailwinds are there, you know, like Solana's taking off as a meme coin chain. I wouldn't be surprised if Telegram bot usage is going up across the board, not just on Solana. And you know, we're just headed into like maybe the largest bull market that crypto has ever seen, and you want to botch that because you didn't have like a formal contract. And like both of these teams are coming out with conflicting statements. It's just like a really, really messy scenario that, sure, I get the want to go to market faster, and maybe outsourcing to a dev shop was the fastest way to do that. But I think, you know, like people run into these like business snafus or like drama all the time outside of crypto too. So this is probably just another case of that.
I would say if the Unibot team on Ethereum trusted some random dev shop without even getting KYC, then like, no offense, but you kind of deserve to get hosed on this front. Like, just launch another deployment if you think you can compete. But I'm pretty sure, at least last time I had checked, Solana volume was absolutely torching Ethereum volume in terms of like which deployment was making more money. So this whole thing just has red flags all over it. Like, I don't even know if we can verify that the Unibot team isn't the ones behind the one on Solana. And I shouldn't speculate on that, but I just want to like highlight the fact that you're trusting these people like pretty much 100% with your funds. So always be careful with the Telegram bot stuff. I would never put like an egregious amount of your net worth on those.
This is a prime example of perfect opportunity and strategy, but absolutely horrible execution. Because as Boccaccio said, they were the first mover in Telegram bots before Telegram bots were everywhere and widely used. They were the first mover and really sort of started an entire trend and sector. And they blew that lead on Ethereum, first of all, but they recognized that Solana was an up-and-coming ecosystem and the perfect place to launch a new Telegram bot. And they completely botched that execution as well. Like, they had the perfect opportunity. They saw it before anybody else did, and they just blew it. So yeah, I guess this is a good lesson to founders that finding the right opportunity is not enough. You have to make sure you execute. And I mean, really, it's as simple as don't let some random developer team that you didn't KYC build using your name and mess everything up. Like, I didn't think this was that hard, but I guess, yeah, this is definitely a tall tale for new founders.
As a whole, though, I do think that Telegram trading bots still do really, really well this cycle. I think Telegram trading bots have been around for like, I don't know, I want to say 1 year or so, and you're starting to see more sort of products and services being launched around them. For example, these days, just like Telegram bots, not trading bots, that make calls for you. You know, they'll highlight like a meme coin on Solana that's at like a 200k market cap. It uses some like time series model, and it basically like sends you like a notification in the Telegram chat to ape this token. And you know, some of them have performed really well. And I think you mix like Telegram trading bots, Telegram trading twos, and maybe some like AI, whether that's BS or not, in there, and you sort of like recreate these like trading groups that we saw like come out in mass last cycle, but it's sort of like the reincarnation in like AI form. I do think that like there's maybe some interesting phase there, to be honest.
Yeah, they're definitely going to start launching AI agent fueled Telegram trading bots. But honestly, what I'm seeing more of is like trading terminals, but not like, not on Telegram, but you can do progressive web app or just on desktop. And I feel like that's kind of, and it's not custodial. So I feel like that might be a better alternative to the Telegram bot thing that we had a few months ago. But I like Telegram bots, NFA, but like, obviously be careful with your keys, etc. But I think they're like, I think they're probably here to stay. I think like, especially if meme coin mania continues.
It's just so convenient, like being able to like be on your phone and Telegram and like make a nice little like $500 play and some coin that this AI agent flagged for you. And you either like hit a zero in 10 minutes or a 10x in 5 hours. Like, I think that's just gambling and people like to gamble. So definitely agree that Telegram bots will continue to be a wave. I have no thoughts, though, on like individual tokens and how those will perform, because you know how it can be when fundamentals are actually tied to the underlying token, as is the case with Unibot. So don't want to speculate there.
Just one last note on sort of like the trading terminal thing. I know like Unibot launched their own terminal, so I don't know how that's doing these days, but in Citico, which is sort of like a more like chat by side of like crypto trading terminal, integrated with Vertex today to provide state-of-the-art execution software. So it'll be interesting to see whether the slightly more like TradFi hedge fund focused like execution terminals integrate with on-chain venues rather than just purely off-chain venues. And I think just one last random point. Last cycle, or maybe in the bear market, I feel like we saw builders try to launch these like copy trading vaults. I think like STFX comes to mind, where you basically like buy in into this idea and then like someone can execute it for you. I don't think that was maybe the best idea, but I think this cycle with like Telegram trading bots, you being able to identify like wallets that are profitable traders, or everyone just copy trading, an AI agent like making calls, I do think that that may be a sort of like interesting sector to look towards. And in some sense, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the more people like buy into this copy trading bot, the higher like price goes up, just because all of these people are aping like the exact same thing when like the Telegram AI, whatever, or the Telegram bot like first makes the call or like makes a notification. So in some sense, I do think that would be like an interesting dynamic to see, and how like reflexive that gets at some point of the cycle. All right, I think that's a good place to call it then. Wesley Boccaccio, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll see you guys next week. Hey everyone, thanks for watching today's Zero X Research episode. I wanted to take a second and remind you about our upcoming 2024 Digital Asset Summit in London this March. Seats are limited, so hit the link in the description and use the promo code 0x10 to save 10% on tickets. See you in London.